every minute of every day is spent thinking about a list.
Charge the ion accelerator. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hello and welcome everyone to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined by Red Powell.
Hello.
And Tanya Gates.
Hi, everybody.
Adam should be back next week. Y'all, thanks for joining us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. You know, coming in to the end of the year. I mean, we're not here for our end of year wrap up just yet. We got two more shows to do. This one and one more.
Oh, man.
What entails a wrap up? Does that mean I have to, like, take inventory of all of the things that I've painted?
We're going to take all the best stuff you've said and repeat it in slow mode and in 1.5 speed.
Yeah, but I think all the best things that I've said have probably been cut out of the actual show.
We do say a lot outside the show.
So this past weekend, Tanya and I did a wrap-up show with Joshua Diffie for the Nova Open Charitable Foundation. Oh,
cool. It's always super fun.
That was cool. No, they do such great work over there and bring highlight to artists and to models, and also these great charities that they're donating towards. And this year, they donated close to $95,000
to charity. So much.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the community coming together. I mean, you're buying raffle tickets for models and armies or units and things. And, you know, I know only one person wins, but really the beneficiaries of these charities win. And it's just such a cool thing to see where people come out and do that year on year on year. And it makes such a big impact. So thanks for doing that. And we announced the winners. This time we didn't do a run-up to the closing. We just jumped in after everything was wrapped up and announced the winners and brought some focus and highlights to the things that were up for raffle. They'll be back for the spring raffles next year. So if you have not checked them out, make sure you do so you can be there, because it's always new things. There are some artists that come back year after year and the things they submit are always gorgeous. Sometimes they're armies, you know, that you're going to want to play with, and sometimes they're display pieces that you want on your hobby shelf or in your house somewhere.
Okay, so I do get asked to do commissions, and I never do commissions because I'm too busy painting my stuff. However, I may or may not have been in contact with Creature Caster to see about putting something in for the next raffle. So it might be a once in a lifetime opportunity for you to actually own something that's painted by me.
I want to do it too. I don't know what I'd put in or if anybody would, I don't want to take away from any of that. I mean, I wouldn't, because it wouldn't be as amazing as yours and the others, but I'm in the spirit of it. I want to get in on it too.
Yeah, let's do it. Red, you going to do it?
I feel like you guys far outclass me in the whole painting realm.
Dude, so I don't know, man. I saw your most recent stuff and it's really good. I would not have believed all that stuff was just contrast or mostly contrast.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm definitely in the shortcut mode, so we'll see.
Okay.
We'll see.
I'm just going to level with you, though, with my orcs, which is kind of what I'm known for. With the exception of the orc skin, everything else is basically just like a base coat, a wash, a layer, and a highlight. Like, that's it. So I don't know. You can have a style and be known for something, and it doesn't have to be super fancy.
Well, let's put our heads together. Let's see if we can do something like an FTN group thing or something. Maybe they'll entertain that from us. We'll see what as we get closer to it.
I'm down.
But make sure you go to the Nova Open Charitable Foundation, bookmark the site, and take a look at what's coming next year. There's gonna be glorious things there. And also this past weekend, I got to go to PAX Unplugged, which is the first time I've been there, where I got to help demo with the Games Workshop events team Kill Team Live for the first time ever.
I saw some pictures of that. That looked cool.
It's basically laser tag, but it's orcs versus humans. The human side use las guns, like actual, I don't know, I say actual las guns, but
actual,
you know,
they're actual.
No, that's pretty much, they actually are flashlights.
Flashlights, right. So it's blasters made to look like a standard issue las gun. And the orcs use shooters. So the orcs side use actual shooters, and they're all the shooters are unique. And, you know, they all have a little bit of, where the humans are very uniform, their weapons are uniform. The orcs are the shooters like you would see on a squad of boys.
Oh, I would have such a hard time, not going, deca, 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 deca.
I don't think you shouldn't do that. You can do that.
I would be such a child.
So the orcs have different stats than the humans. Orcs are a little bit beefier. Humans are a little bit squishier, and they have different weapon profiles. Like the orcs have, the humans have two modes of fire, single fire or automatic. I don't know why you wouldn't just go automatic all the time. The orcs only have full-on Daka mode, and the weapons do a little bit more damage, but they reload a little bit slower than the human side. So it kind of balances out. We saw, humans and orcs flip-flop in victories the whole time, but it's played in an arena. And the cool thing that different than just regular old laser tag is that you're actually battling for objectives. So what we ran at the event was mission one from the kill team missions.
Oh, cool. Nice.
Yeah, it was really great. There's a couple different ways to
participate. Well, how'd it go?
Oh, yeah. I mean, ran, I don't know, 1,000 plus people through over the course of the weekend.
Nice. That's pretty cool.
It was incredibly fun. And enjoyed it. The guns have some weight to them, too. So when you're in there playing, it's an 8-minute game, you feel like you're really in it. Everybody came out of this moment.
Nice.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping it gets rolled out to other events and people get to experience. I think people are really going to have a good time with it. It was. All the terrain and not obstacles, but barricades and stuff in the arena, they're all themed around Warhammer 40,000 as well.
That's cool.
Yeah, we had smoke machine going, music playing.
Was it like music from Dawn of War?
It was some pretty epic music.
Yeah.
I don't know sweet. If it was, I think it might be specific to this event, but it was fun. And, a lot of people, once they realized what we were doing, because I don't think... We told anybody at the convention. It became pretty popular, so it was cool.
So was there anybody afterwards who was like then wanted to check out what Kill Team actually was?
Oh yeah, yeah. There was actually a promo they were doing that site on site there that allowed people to pick up purchase the Kill Team box set a little bit easier. And I'm pretty sure they sold a ton of them. Yeah.
Awesome.
Because Kill Team is a two-player game, and it comes with everything you need to play right in the box.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a good box set.
Yeah, very solid. I mean, you get cool terrain, cool models, playing surface, dice, the rule book. So yeah, folks definitely jumped in, and folks, yeah, I would ask him. I was actually out front. I was like, you know anything about Warhammer? It's a little bit. It was a lot of people there where I used to play Warhammer, or my brother or sister played Warhammer. That kind of stuff. And had an interest after the fact, which is neat. It's kind of hard not to feel like you're, because you're carrying those. A lot of people wanted to hold the gun, because it's pretty impressive.
it would be super cool to like actually hold a las gun after struggling with guard for 2 years.
You're not getting in, just go full auto. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was fun. I got to play a couple games as well. Had a great time. I don't know where it's going to be. A lot of people were asking, where are you going to be next? Where are you going to be next? Because to them, like, this was their whole thing. Is like, is this Warhammer? Because this is awesome. I'm like, well, I got something to tell you. The stories and the other stuff is also awesome. Like, yes, this is actually awesome and it's fun, but there's all this other stuff. And, I don't know where it's going to go next. It's up to the event organizers. But I will say it was cool, or is cool. I think
it seems like something that they should have at Warhammer World, don't you think?
There is Warhammer World is a destination spot,
right?
Yeah, it is. But you got the museum there, and then Bugman's.
Ah, it's on my bucket list someday.
Yeah, when you can sit in Bugman's and have a beer and have a nice lunch or breakfast, they serve breakfast there also. It feels really good.
Someday.
Yeah, it's worth it. I know we talked about it before, but it's about, well, you can take the two different trains up there. One's a little bit faster, but it takes about an hour and 40 minutes or so to get there from London proper, like center of London to Nottingham. The train drops you off a 5-minute car ride from Warhammer World, and then you could spend all day in Warhammer World.
I mean, you don't need to sell me on it.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying it's accessible. I think if you're already going to London and you have a day to burn, you can get up there, spend all day, and you go early on the train, spend all day in Warhammer World, and then get back to London. And
if there's anybody out there who wants to sponsor me to go to the LGT and Warhammer World, call me. Slide into my DMs.
Well, if you're going, just go a day early and see. You can swing it. You can't swing it.
Yeah.
It's a fun trip. Anyway, so that was it. PAX Unplugged, first time I've been to Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a cool city. What I what I found most interesting was that some of the alleyways between the buildings are just like horse trails. You know, they're not actual alleys that you'd see in a city that was built modern, you know, or wasn't one of the original cities.
See, and then I live in Western Canada, and like anything that's like constructed before 1910, you're like, oh man, that's so old.
Oh, so I have a coworker in the UK, and their house is older than our country. So.
Amazing.
Yeah, about like a generation. It's just, yeah, cool times. Yes, but anyway, yeah. Perspective. So then going from Atlanta up to Philadelphia, and then walking through some of the streets and seeing that stuff, it was neat. So, thankful to be able to travel and do stuff as part of this hobby, and we're, you know, getting back to be able to do this.
Oh man, so speaking of traveling, I am trying to get my act together so I can go to LVO, and I just feel like everywhere I turn there's just like an extra thing that I have to do. So I let my passport expire, and that was like,
oh no,
the biggest mistake, and I have enough time to do it. I go down to the passport office, and then the passport office lady is like, oh, you're missing something. And I was like, what? This is what I needed last time. This is everything. And she's like, no, you need your marriage certificate. I was like, oh,
no. Because your name had changed, maybe?
I guess. I don't know. Apparently, as soon as you let your passport expire in Canada, if your new name doesn't match your birth name, then you got it anyway. So I spent my whole day today looking for that. So everybody, cross your fingers for me that I can get my passport in time to go to LVO.
I hope so. Yeah, that's travel so tedious, and then like certain countries get visas for and that kind of stuff. It's, I mean, I don't think you have to get one to come into the United States, but
nah. Now, when I think Canada and the United States are homies, you know,
use America's hat.
It's a very, very large hat.
Good, very good.
So I made some progress on my Death Guard. I know that you probably guys are probably tired of hearing me talk about the Death Guard Terminators, but I'm painting like 30 Terminators at once.
I was just going to say, you're probably sick and tired of painting 30 Terminators.
Well, it's actually been fun, the whole time, you know, because I like it, seeing things take shape, and then working with a certain color palette, trying to make things, you know, look like a kind of a muted, imposing at the same time, but using some pastels, like trying to work all these things, trying to have like subtle tentacles and some more apparent tentacles. I mean,
subtle tentacles.
It's hard to describe. You know what I'm saying? Anybody's painted a bunch of Death Guard, you know what I'm saying? A little bit of subtle tentacles. But I finally got to the weapons today. So I think on the last show, I talked about how I was planning on doing the weapons, like plague bearer swords. Mm-hmm. And I tried that, and I know there's a bunch of different ways, but I was going to try that, you know, basing it like Incubi Darkness or Dark Reaper or something, and then building up to like a crisp highlight from there. And I tried it, and I just didn't like it. I couldn't make it work. So in my mind, I still think it would have been a good choice, but I was not able to execute it in the way that I thought was the best. And I just couldn't get it right. So I switched it up, and Adam and I actually talked about doing some stuff, you know, with Caribur Crimson. And I tried that, and I didn't like that. I couldn't make it work. It was like, I'm sure with enough messing around with and tinkering about it, I'll get it liking it. But I finally just scrapped all that, and I went with Lead Belcher as a base, two coats of Agrax Earthshade, and not necessarily even coats, but like two-thirds, three-fourths of a coat, you know, in different places around the weapons. And then sponged on Troll Slayer Orange as rust, and then went back and just did that kind of like jagged highlight with a bright silver on the edge of the weapon.
Have you ever tried painting just like a normal opaque paint onto something and then dry brush metallic onto it?
I've done that before. And that was actually one of the tutorials that I found had something like that. It was where like they coated the weapon in Typhus Corrosion.
Oh.
And then
how'd that go?
It turned out great. I just really didn't feel like waiting on Typhus Corrosion to dry on 30 Terminators. I mean, that's really, I hate to say that was the choice I made, mm-hmm. but that was the choice I made. I just didn't feel like doing it. And the weapons have a little bit of texture built into, like molded into them. And I mm-hmm. felt like between the molding of the texture and then my stipple, that what I knew I was going to sponge on, and then maybe some stippling with the highlights, I could engineer, you know, manufacture some visual texture on the models and not have to fool with my Typhus Corrosion.
Mm-hmm. So I think we talked a little bit before about how much I really dislike painting metallics.
It's the biggest blocking in metallics. I do feel like is the biggest chore.
Yeah, so it's why I don't do it.
I like that that firm stance.
I don't do it now unless the majority of the model is not metallics. But like say I'm painting a Scout Sentinel where there's a lot of like metal parts potentially on it, I will literally just like prime it black and then do a really heavy like metallic dry brush over the entire model, and then I will pick out all the other colors after the fact, and then maybe I'll do an edge highlight on the silver if it needs to be like brightened up a little bit, but just here and there, not everywhere. But yeah,
I have started doing that because for a while I don't think that I was sophisticated enough to do that like final bright highlight on things,
mm-hmm.
like the Stormhold silver or whatever, mithril or whatever it is, and I think I've gotten a little bit better. My highlights are still kind of chunky, but I've started doing that, and I do think it makes a difference.
You know what I should do? I should send you some of the brushes that I use for edge highlighting, and then maybe they would help you.
Look, you know, technique or product. I'm willing to try whatever it takes.
Well, these brushes are super cheap, so if you hate them or you just want to use them for like base coating or whatever, like it's literally going to cost me more to ship them to you. So.
Well, show me where they go. See if I can pick them up locally at a craft store.
I've never been able to find them online because they are like made in China. They are just called Oriental Art Brush Round Number 10. That's it.
Okay.
They're only in one store in my town, and they are the best. Everybody in my local scene uses them, and we can't find them anywhere else.
I've gone all fancy. I've actually started using some of the Artificer brushes, and I do like them.
Yeah.
Like, I was a holdout for a long time, but they have kept their point longer than any other brush that I've owned.
So what I found, and of course, painting in brushes and stuff are all like completely like user experience, and whatever you like is going to be different from what I like. But you know how when you use a brush and it gets to the point where it's got a little bit of a hook on the end?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I love that for edge highlighting. That is like where the sweet spot is for me, is when that brush has that hook on the end. Mwah, chef's kiss. Perfect.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, I have used a brush with a hook before, but I normally just find myself fighting with it the entire time.
Oh, no, you have to become one with the hook at the end of the brush.
It's like an extension of your heart.
That's right. You got to let the paint and the brush do the work for you.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm still at the stage with these Terminators to where there's that bit of a mass of green, but I am at the point now where I feel like I can do their bases, and then I've saved their faces for last. I know that's, but I have not painted their faces in the same like batch painting stuff that I've done because I really want to go and do a little time on that. That's kind of like Secrets to Good Model, which we talked about in the past. Make the faces look good, make the bases look good. People forgive you for the rest of the stuff.
And I think we talked about this before as well. Like, I used to put so much effort into like everything, right? Like trying so hard to fit the brush into like the armpit, you know, and all this behind a shield, and nobody but you is going to see that. I promise nobody's looking that hard unless you're putting it into a painting competition. But like, it's
okay. They end up looking for reasons to rule you out, you know, kind of thing.
That's right. You can leave that spot behind the shield. It's fine. Nobody's going to see it.
Yeah. I got all the way through painting the cloaks, the outside and the inside of the cloaks, and I forgot to paint the inside of one cloak. And I was like, you know what?
Nobody's going to see it.
I think it's going to be fine. I'll catch it up later, but I didn't stop the presses and go get the paint and do it right there.
Nah. You know what you do? You just like ask a buddy to come over. You take it to the game store and be like, look at this thing that I painted. And if nobody says anything, just leave it.
Yeah. Oh, they're all going to look. I mean, if they're all getting on the table at the same time. It's like, what is that? That like humans seem to look more attractive if they're in groups.
Is that true?
I think it's a phenomenon. I'm not actually sure about that, but I've heard that before.
I'm going to do some research on it. I'll get back to you on that one.
Yeah. But I'm like, you know, there's a certain quality of the quantity of 36 Terminators.
So what you're saying is if I want to look really good, I just got to get like five of my best friends to come out with me.
I don't know if this is actually true. I remember reading it somewhere, but
science. I'm doing it. Never going out alone.
Whatever that phenomenon is, I hope it can apply to these Terminators. Although I do think they look pretty good. I've actually posted some pretty close-up shots. I don't even know why I do that. Why am I posting close-up shots of things?
Because they're miniatures. That's what you do.
Yeah, I guess you got to get down.
You got to highlight your favorite parts.
I'm pretty pleased with how they're looking. So, you know, gonna try to keep it going.
That's awesome. I have way too many projects on my paint table right now. So I've decided this week I'm just going to finish stuff. I've got a Telemon I got to base. I got some edge highlighting on an Mega Armored War Boss. And I've got a really pretty creature caster model that I want to finish as well.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very nice. So I'll say my hobby desk will certainly get cleaned up when you move these 30-something 40-millimeter bases off of them.
Yeah, but doesn't it feel so good when you do? You're like, yeah, I finished that.
It really will. And I got to play a game with them. You know, I was already all thinking, of them? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's not even that. I mean, it's a ton of points, but
yeah,
a unit of 10 Blight Lords is 400 points. So it's 800 points in Blight Lords. And then another 400 points, probably, you know, give or take a few points in Death Shroud Terminators.
Ugh.
So then just throw a couple of PBCs down, some Boxwalkers, and we're ready to rock.
Oh, man. Well,
I mean, a couple character models also, but you know what I'm saying? You know, it's almost an army right here.
It is. It's, I mean, depending on your point level, it is an army. Just need an HQ.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to getting them. So I got some buddies that want to fight. So one of them is painting a Black Templar force, a new Black Templar force, and one of them has a Grey Knight force.
Nice.
And they want to pair up and square off against Death Guard. So nice. I will oblige them.
That's awesome. So they'll play 1,000 and 1,000, and you'll play 2,000?
I think that's the plan, yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to get the Flesh Mowers, the Fetid Blight Drones, and all these Terminators, maybe play Burst Crawler or two.
Honestly, that's the way to do it, because I feel like when you play 1v1v1, it always feels like somebody's getting ganged up on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Definitely going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. They think I'm locked in there with them. No. They're also fairly new. They've been playing skirmish games, you know, skirmish level Warhammer, and it's going to be their big jump into this edition proper.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Have my last game with Guard on Monday.
And is that for the league?
Retired. Yep, it's for the league. And then I'm done. On to bigger and better things.
What are you running with? Is it like a crescendo? What point level are you at now? Are you fighting for control of a sector?
No, it's like a semi-competitive kind of league, and it's a league where you can change the list from round to round, but you have to keep your warlord and his faction the same, and then you can like add in legal allies and stuff like that. So I was always playing Guard and Custodes. So for this last game, it's still Guard and Custodes technically, but it's going to be like more Custodes than Guard this time around. So I'm going up against Grey Knights though. I don't think I've ever in 2 years played against Grey Knights.
Well, you picked
not
the
true.
Worst time.
I had one game. Yeah.
To start.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm excited. I'm excited to see what's going to happen. My opponent was saying, oh, two Telemons, huh? Seems kind of mean. And I was like,
how many Dread Knights are they running?
Grey Knights? I don't know. I haven't looked at his list yet.
Yeah, if it's more than one, then they can stop their trap flapping.
I don't even feel bad about it because
you absolutely shouldn't.
You know, because, I mean, I feel like I've been everybody's punching bag all season, so... I don't feel bad.
Now you're going to be punching back with D3 or whatever it is. Or not D3, damage 3 is what I mean. But
damage 4?
Are there 4? That's right, yeah.
Feels so good.
Yeah, still, I mean, Grey Knights are pretty formidable.
Yeah, but I'm excited. I think it's going to be fun.
Of course, joking. They are just very good right now because they have lots of shots, some psychic powers. Although you're somewhat resistant with the Custodes with psychic powers.
Yeah, I mean, they've got like innate feel no pain. Yeah. Only in the psychic phase, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's when they'll dish out a lot of mortal wound damage in psychic phase. Or they can dish out a lot of mortal wound damage.
Mm-hmm.
Are you taking like a primary psyker on your guard side to maybe throw in a deny?
No. No, because the Custodes can do it, right?
Yeah.
If there's something that targets a Custodes unit, you can do like the pay 1 CP and roll a 4 up and it just like negates it.
Yeah, Grey Knights have a lot of things that buff them too, giving them extra potency. Look, I'm not saying how to stack your list against but if you could throw in a primary psyker, they're not that expensive.
I mean, I could. I have two. I could, but then I can't take Abhor the Witch.
Oh, that's true.
So I think Abhor the Witch is kind of good, don't you think?
That's a great one. That's good. Yeah, anytime you can have a kind of a gimme on the secondaries, that is not a bad thing.
Yeah. So yeah, I think I'll stay psychic free. Plus, it's fluffy, right?
Oh, I
You
mean.
gonna bring some sisters?
I have a unit of sisters actually on my painting desk right now, but I don't think I'm gonna bring them for this one.
Well, okay. Well, there's minus points in fluff there, Tanya. So.
I will have two squads painted though when the new book drops,
Well, at
so.
least you painted them. So, but if you bring them in your list, you'll get plus points from me for lore.
Oh,
So.
you're talking about Sisters of Silence is what you're.
Sisters of Silence, that's
Yeah.
right. Yeah, I've got a unit of Vigilators on the paint desk right now.
They are cool models.
Okay.
I like that throwback to the, because they look very much like the art. I know we talk about a lot of the hero characters that have been coming out just like the art, but those Sisters of Silence models were one of the first that were kind of like the art walking off the page.
Oh
Yeah.
man, so I am reading Prospero Burns right now, and like no spoilers, but there's a part where like the main
Prospero
character,
Burns.
yeah. Oh no, you're not supposed to give me a minute. Anyway, there's a part where the main character goes into like this room and it's like filled with sisters, and like that's where I'm at right now, and I just like it feels so creepy. Like Dan Abnett does such a good job of like getting that creep factor in, right? Because Sisters of Silence are essentially soulless and they kind of give
Soulless
you
and
that like the heebie-jeebies
the
kind of
blanket
feeling.
of the null, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm reading that and I'm like, oh, this is so good.
I think we all know someone out there with the pariah gene. You know what I mean? Like, you met that person, you're like, man, what's going on there? And what little do you know is just that weird feeling is actually they're going to be the bulwark against all the psychers in the future. They just have to
Oh,
well.
our
So you get, everyone's going to have one in their party. That's
that's right. That's right.
all our hope rests on them.
Just keep that in mind,
Well,
folks.
good luck in that league game and the move
Yeah.
towards the Custodes. They just look
Yeah.
good.
Yeah, and I had another game last Saturday with full custodies as well, and 75% win rate now, man. Like maybe I should just, keep on keeping on.
Oh wow. Yeah, pull the band-aid off. Get on in there.
Yeah, I joined a TTS league, so
Nice.
get those games in.
Yeah, rock and roll. And Custodes, I mean, not too difficult to get on the table. I mean, if you go with a traditional color scheme, anybody out there is looking like with low model count, traveling, like it's got checks off a lot of boxes.
They look good. I mean,
Going to the game room and I have this like giant tray that I used to have to bring all of my guard in with. Like it's huge. It's like over 2 feet long. And just out of habit, I just like put all my custodes in it and I bring in this huge tray and I'm looking at it. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. I could have put this in a shoebox.
there is something to be cool. He's like just a couple of handfuls.
Yeah. So I have to figure out something else to transport these models in.
Yeah, I have a few custodes. And when I say few, I've got like a you. Everyone had the three shield captains,
Fair.
and one or two squads of the guardians. And then yeah, that's about it.
That gets you to about 1,000 points.
Yeah, I feel like it's about half an army.
Yeah.
And Valoris, I've got it. So there's what I'm up to, about 1,500 at this point.
Everybody jokes like, "Oh, what is it? Like 12 models?" And I'm like, "Well, it is. It's 22. It's 22 models for 2,000
Man, I
points."
could be. You mean I could have already had a Custodes army and not had these
Yeah.
30 death cards? I'm kidding. I'm certainly still do it, but I might do both. Look, there's value in that, especially if we talk about like we were just so I just did this show, the Thursday show, and we talked about forgiving armies and like armies that need barriers of entries and that kind of stuff, and we kind of came to the conclusion that there are no low skill armies, but there are some that are more forgiving than others. Tanya, do you feel like the Custodes fall into that forgiving category?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that was one of my biggest takeaways. Because keep in mind, I'm only four games in with pure custodies. I only had I had seven models that I was sort of allying in with my guard for a while, and So four games in with Pure Custodes, and the fact that they were so forgiving, like if I did, like if I didn't maneuver myself correctly and like didn't quite get one in behind cover, and that would normally be a mistake. That would be a huge mistake in guard, right? You'd lose a whole squad. But because the custodians are so tough, they are more forgiving, right? They will, you might lose one depending on what's shooting at you, but chances are you're not going to lose like the whole squad because of that. And it was really frustrating watching other people that I was playing against make mistakes like that and be able to continue on with the game. And but now I get to experience it a little bit, and it's like I get to see where I've made a mistake, but still continue to play the game and not feel like I'm immediately on the back foot. So
on the other side of that, I think it's even more critical where you move your models when you have fewer of them.
I was going to say,
you always have to be focused on where you're going next, and then making sure you pick secondaries you can achieve.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm at now with my learning experience is the secondaries. I have pinpointed that is my weakest part with the new faction. So I do have a coach, and that's what we're going to be working on next. So I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, heck yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think, Paul, that was a great point in regards of I think custodes, they're forgiving mechanically, to your point, Tanya. You know, they're just durable. They can take a lot. But I think gameplay-wise, I think that they have a window that, especially as we look at some of the mechanics that they've teased and everything, the katas and the stances and everything, I think that that's going to become something where if those things, they'll only take it so far mechanically before, Paul, you mentioned kind of the threshold or the ceiling of skill that's going to come in to double down on those additional factors they have now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think they're going to get some infusion of new tactics and new stuff. And I know Custodes players are anxious to know what the new book brings. And we are too. We'll bring you that news as soon as we have it. What's that?
I'm so excited.
Yeah, and I'm just going to enjoy seeing people get their models ready. I will say that's the coolest thing about like my Twitter. I just keep it all hobby folks, and same with Instagram, and just seeing just the wonderful stuff that people are doing right now. Mm-hmm. And this is a good downtime. Like, I know people are got like, you know, holiday stuff to do and probably stressing about that. But if you can find a few moments to get some moments of zen, you know, with painting and getting some stuff ready for tournaments next year, I highly encourage it. Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back. Keep the strain going.
Nice.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
We are back. Thanks for sticking with us. And please, please check out our sponsor. Such a great ally and friend of the show. Completely worth checking out Jay and what he's got going on over there. So let's talk about a couple things, both directed at the Warhammer community site. So there is the MetaWatch article, which I know people just love to take jabs at. But we'll talk about that and why. And then also some stuff coming out kind of out of nowhere about the Tau. Let's talk about that first.
I don't know about you, but it kind of caught me off guard. I guess we should have seen it coming more. And for those out there that were expecting it, like, good on you. But I was surprised to see him go in. I mean, even to drop, I'll start with what's his name? They remade the model, Darkstrider. I liked him before. I thought he was a pretty cool build-in. And now they've kind of stepped up, I think, his structural analyzer. You can select one friendly Tau Sept Core unit within 6 inches of this model and one enemy unit visible to this model until the end of the turn. Each time a model in that Tau Sept Core unit makes a ranged attack against that enemy unit, add one to that attack's wound roll. I think that's pretty good given all of Tau and their ability to... I mean, that's if there's anything that you'd want, it's adding one to the wound roll, given we don't know all the changes to marker lights
might do. And, you know, right. You feel like there are probably going to be ways to beef up the hits to hit like it is now, but maybe not on that wound section.
Well, and then you take into account. So we bounce from that into, you know, they brought us, they showed us the two new tactical philosophies of the Tau. So Mont Ka, the killing blow, it's good. I think that it plays out well, but just because I'm talking about Darkstrider, I'll go to Kalyan first. How do you say it?
That's close enough.
Yeah, sure. I'll take it. So we go into this, and so this is supposed to be the more cautious approach, and I think that they demonstrate that by making it battle rounds 3 through 5. Yeah, the patient hunter. So battle rounds 3 through 5. This unit is eligible to shoot in a turn in which it fell back, but if it does, then until the end of the turn, each time a model in this unit makes a ranged attack, subtract 1 from that attack's hit roll. Again, I think marker lights might have something to say about that. Each time a model in this unit makes a ranged attack that targets the closest eligible enemy unit within 12 inches, if that model is not within engagement range of any enemy units and did not fall back this turn on an unmodified hit roll of the value shown in the table below, if that attack scores a hit, it scores 1 additional hit, which is, I mean, this is, you know, talking about just pure volume, current battle rounds.
And this is presumably, you know, they'll have that sept. Like right. In brackets, and so anything that you can put the Kai on, sept on, maybe it gets this ability.
Right, and so then you go to current battle round. So battle round 4 on a 5 or higher, you're scoring an additional hit. Battle round 3, it's 6. It goes 6-5-4 from 3-4-5, right? And so it just gets better by the end.
So the premise of these philosophies is that you get benefits based on the turn of the game, what battle round it is, right. 1 through 5. And so 3 through 5, you're going to get this extra ability.
And it's just going to keep building into the later game. And so I'll talk more about what I think, like how that plays in mechanically and tactically. But we'll go ahead and cover.
About around 3 through 5, you can shoot when you fall back with Kion.
Correct, yeah.
And then if you have this other thing where you score additional hits based on what you roll, and I think this is crazy powerful.
I think that there's a lot of play to it. I understand there are... There's some degrees, probably, I mean, some folks' frustration in that there's not as much flexibility to it. It does play itself out in round 3 and 5. And I think even, you know, you mentioned the MetaWatch article, there's something to how the first turn goes. And I think that's obviously something historical. That's not a surprise to anybody. And so you've really got to, if you're going to go with a patient hunter, you've got to have something that plays to its own strength in the first turn, and then use this to really close the game down in turns 3 through 5, which I think is
Storm Surges on the table. This is an excuse to put Storm Surges. I mean, I love that model.
Yeah, I mean, and again, going back to Darkstrider, you know, just that many more hits to getting +1 to wound. So there's a lot to that. I think it's pretty good. You do have to be within, you know, the closest eligible enemy unit within 12 inches. And so that, you know, it's kind of interesting in that I see some Farsight Enclave, which had similar aspects to that. So I'll be really interested to see how the SEPs build.
Well, you can move. I mean, when you know you're going to get this off, especially, let's say, a bottom of the round.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to be closing that distance, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's cool. So you know, that's the patient hunter. Then we go to the killing blow, Mont Ka. So battle rounds 1 through 3. So like we're talking about right up there in the beginning of the game, each time this unit makes a normal move or advances in your movement phase until the end of your shooting phase, it counts as having remained stationary. Huge for some of these heavy weapons, huge for just so many aspects to what they have. Each time a model in this unit makes a ranged attack that targets the closest eligible enemy unit within the range shown in the table below, improve the armor penetration characteristic of that attack by 1 and reroll a wound roll of 1. So current battle round 1 through 3, the ranges go accordingly. 18 inches in the first round, 12 inches in the second round, 9 inches in the third round. I mean, how different is this really from what Iron Hands were getting in 8th edition to certain extents?
That's a good analogy.
Right. I mean, it's, you're essentially giving them, now of course you have the range aspect to it, but you're giving them Iron Hand buffs for the first 3 rounds of the game.
You are getting like super close though with 8.
Yeah.
So I guess presumably though, this is when the enemy is advancing on you, to where with the board size being what it is, yeah, they're going to be coming towards you as well.
Right. I mean, and to that point, it almost, there's some benefits to going second in the first turn with that, because they've got to close the distance, presumably.
Yeah. So maybe if you have, I don't know, how far are you going to move? Presumably if they're coming to you, you have less distance to go to them, so you can close in with that 18 inches if you want to, and potentially evaporate whatever's right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
the armor penetration improved by 1 and then re-rolling wound rolls of 1, that seems like a good combo.
I think it's, I mean, and then not taking a penalty with your heavy weapons. I think that there's, and who knows what other things they have that if you remain stationary, you get these bonuses. There could be more to that.
That's interesting, though. I mean, because with the move in advance.
I mean, advance, right? There's a lot of space that can be covered in that distance.
I mean, why wouldn't you do that if you automatically count as being stationary?
Right, exactly.
You can go anywhere you want. You don't have to go towards the enemy. You just be somewhere else.
And that has nothing to do with ranges or anything, right? You just get that benefit.
Yeah.
For the first three turns of the game. It's pretty awesome.
That opens up. So I approach this. I mean, I'm a brewer. I build list basically every minute of every day that I'm not doing something else. It's spent thinking about a list. and how to approach it, right? But I like this opens up because it really changes what you might consider good. And I'm using good in air quotes, what you might consider efficient, playable.
We go back to some of the other discussions we had, right? I mean, this might not be, think back to Death Guard, right? When disgustingly resilient changed, I think people didn't necessarily agree with what they were seeing in the change. But over time, we were able to see that it was just that much better in its own way.
Neg one damage played out, right. Especially when everyone went to doing damage to weapons.
Exactly.
And now everyone's scrambling to figure out how to get neg one damage in their army
list. Right. So we've only got a piece of the pie here, a piece of the puzzle. And I think that it's not a bad look. I understand that there's different aspects to it. And of course, different armies have different benefits. You know, the Necrons and the Custodes have similar aspects to their like full army benefit, right? Like talking about stances versus protocols or so forth. This, while this isn't as adaptable in certain ways as doctrines for Space Marines, I think that there's probably more to it than what we're just looking at. This is literally maybe half a page of a codex, and so it's just not fair,
even a full page
to take it
in a 100-page book or whatever. Yeah.
I don't think it's fair to take it just at a glance by itself. I mean, it might even look, it could be the other way. It might look strong, and then they don't have other options. But I'm sure they
get out there and get some storm surges and some ghost keels.
I think ghost kills have always been great. I think that's just something that
they look cool, but they're in a rough spot right now. I mean, that's another one of those models. Like I own just a handful of Tau, not a bunch, but I've always been like, especially after they had that second wave of suits, I can get behind this.
Mm. Good stuff. Again, I did not see this coming. And so I was really glad to see some of the more adjustments come in, and with everything they have, I know Tau isn't necessarily the most prominent right now, but
I look at stats at tournaments every week, week in, week out, and Tau are a very much underrepresented faction right now.
Sure.
A lot of contributing factors to that is that, of course, terrain gets more advanced. And so this book is going to have a way to address the ninth edition terrain.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Can I ask how breachers fit into Mon Cal? Right? Because they get better the closer they get to the enemy, right? Is this kind of, is this going to make them more of a viable unit for Tau?
I think to a certain point. I mean, they're especially, again, going back to Farsight Enclave, they were really good in certain builds with that. I think that you take them now and you look at it and you can say, okay, breachers, this range is this much better versus this range, this much better. And so, okay, current battle round at 1 at 18 inches, they're just getting that much of a buff. But you're advancing, right? And you're not taking the penalty. Everyone's concerned about the fact that they've been ballistic skill 4 in a lot of cases, but now they're not getting a penalty for advancing. And then you add on marker weights. And I think it's pretty, I think that there's a lot of good synergy there.
Let's also talk about that the pulse carbine and the pulse rifle have been improved.
Right. Exactly. That's another huge thing, really, not to be overlooked.
Yeah. So this is, kind of a beef up all around. Yeah, maybe we'll get this faction on the table. Because right now, again, just seeing... Now, I mean, I know people like the faction and collected and have had armies and whatever. But, when they go to tournaments, they're opting for another faction at the moment, by and large.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so maybe this would be what it takes. And I will say, these rules we've seen, seemingly pretty good. It's going to be cool to see. Because I guess you can assume that every sept has these, turn elements associated with them.
Right. Yeah, something to that aspect. And I wonder if there's certain ones. I mean, Shadow Sun used to be able to choose between them, right? And so if you could have both, think of that.
Oh, here we go. I'm sure Tau players are wringing their hands Very much probably like Custodes and Genestealer calls, like, just give us the book. Just give us.
Can I pay for the book now and get a PDF? Something I could do.
Genestealer calls too, like those, that's, I mean, we can talk briefly about them before we jump into the Metabotra article. Is I know the people, that's another one that's an unrepresentative faction right now. And also like really keen to see how it all comes together for them. And
all the Genestealer cult players that I know are like extremely talented players of the game. So I'm sure it'll be whatever new rules they get. I'm sure it'll be devastating in their hands, but it'll be really interesting to see where it ends up as a faction within the meta. You know,
well, it's tough to be a GSC player right now because there's so many different ways to build out units and like with equipment and function and stuff. And they're all like, I don't even know what to do right now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is understandable.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate, right? Coming from another sort of underrepresented faction, and I really do think that, like, the only reason why we're seeing so many Astra Militarum lists, I think, is because the faction is older and has more fans than Genestealer cults. It's like one of like the beloved, like, classic factions.
Well, the core, the profile, like the silhouette of the army has not changed much over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whereas I think Genestealer cult is still kind of like a newer army, and I actually think Genestealer cult is harder to play than Guard.
Oh, I
like,
in terms
of the rules, like Guard is a little bit point and shoot, and I think that the hard part is just keeping your stuff alive, and really knowing how to like focus fire, because your ballistic skill is kind of poopy. So you have to make sure that you are building like redundancy in to make sure you're killing stuff. But like Genestealer cult has so many like special rules and mechanics and stuff that I think actually takes a really long time to master.
With Astra Militarum, you'd be like, I'm just going to, when in doubt, you could just probably build another squad of las gunners, you know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, on Genestealer calls, like, oh, these sprues got so many arms, so many different little guns and stuff on them. What do I
just stick all of the arms on?
You probably wouldn't go wrong with that either. I don't know, maybe build some Goliaths or some Aberrants. I doubt anyone ever has too many Aberrants or Goliaths. I haven't seen a bunch of them on the table either.
Saw a bunch of rock grinders on the table the other day.
Oh, that's the Goliath. That's the truck.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool. So somebody has enough, I guess.
Alex McDougal does.
Prepared for any situation, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of, let's talk about this MetaWatch article where it goes down some stats. I love it because stats are stats, just numbers. It just sometimes it just is. And I've seen a lot of criticism on there. It's like, oh, the sample size. Like, well, yeah, you gotta start somewhere. You gotta build up some information somewhere. And we're looking at the U.S. Open events, and these were actual games played by actual people, and some of them incredibly skilled players at actual events. And so it's a good place to look at. And the format is also slightly different. I feel like the format will be adapted by other events because the terrain layout is very easy to accomplish. And a mission structure, you know, basically right out of the book. So there you go, already there for you. I've also heard people talk about how they didn't think that the competition was exceptionally strong at some of these events. And I think that I'm just going to come out and say it. I think those are basically like nothing arguments. Those are just things that people would like to maybe find ways to not consider the stats and the outcomes of these events. But I will say that some of the best people, best players in the world in attendance at lots of the events and played out actual games and in many cases played every game in the tournament. And so that in itself is data to just look at. And anytime you're looking at data, you just looking at it objectively as what does it mean to you? And the answer could be nothing. That's also a very good answer. The data can be nothing to you. Or you just look at it and go, well, let's see if we can make this useful. And I don't think we needed a spreadsheet or a graph to tell us that Drukhari are very strong.
Womp womp.
But it's interesting to think that also that a lot of these Tyranid numbers came out like after that little nudge with the Wars on Octarius. I also think that Blood Angels probably have a higher win rate than our representative.
Sure, you do. I'm sure you do think that.
But it's also interesting to think that orcs are kind of at that 50% line. Based on the stats. So we know how strong the orcs were, but the orcs were only had, like, and you look at it in the context of the orcs had only one event with all the buggies to exist in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had people that vacated factions to go in favor of other factions chasing that kind of bleeding edge of the meta. So these are all contributors to the numbers. I'm not saying that makes the numbers wrong, because you have to look at what the numbers are and see it's kind of weird that Harlequins and Adeptic Studies are as high as they are.
Is this because there's only like a few people representing those factions, right?
Yeah, it could be.
Because when you look at Necrons way down there at the bottom, well, and also Adeptus Astartes, well, most people, I would imagine, especially most new players coming into the hobby, are going to have one of those two factions, right? Because new players probably bought Indomitus, which had both of those, whereas more experienced players probably are going to go for maybe a rarer faction, Harlequins or Drukhari or something like that.
Something that has not had a box set recently.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw that idea out there. And I feel like numbers need to be adjusted based off how many people are playing them, right? Like, if Richard Siegler only played Tau at these events and then had he was the only one, and then that blew the win rate right out of the water, well, you could look at this and be like, oh, wow, look at that 100% win rate with Tau. They must be so good.
Well,
but
with Chaos Demons, too, I think this is supported by a couple of just champion players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that have done really well with the faction specialist. That's a concept I want to dive deeper into in shows is how do you become a faction specialist? And even if you do that, it doesn't eliminate your need to adapt to the meta.
Mm-hmm.
But it you may be playing with models that you have a better appreciation for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, I always look at stats like this, and I think, especially a chart like this is only telling us one part of the equation, mm-hmm. and I am always left with more questions than answers when I see an infographic like this.
I don't think that's a bad thing in the concept of playing Warhammer 40,000.
No, because... but I do think that people just need to sort of dig a little bit deeper into stats, just a little bit, you know?
Yes. I'm 100% agreeing on that as well.
I think along with that, I mean, it's kind of like a lot of other things out there. Suddenly people, become expert statisticians and can suddenly read off, understanding what they think the right values
research.
Are. Yeah. Yeah.
I've watched two YouTube videos on this.
Exactly. So it makes for some interesting debates, or at least some interesting reads. I'll say that much. Watching the comments on some of this.
Ooh, you read the comments?
You got to read the comments. It's tough.
Got to.
Like 20% of my day. So.
Now
it is. It's just data. You just look at it is what it is. But you can see what's. I like looking at this and thinking that. It's possible to do well, with some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me want to dig in. Is like, who was playing what? What did they take? What was successful? What was not successful? I mean, look, I know I've talked a lot about Death Guard because I've been living it for the last several weeks with all these models. But, and I talk about it, I try to be, kind of a joking way, but I think a lot of people are not doing as better with Death Guard because they are taking what they think is the right list, because this is the most point efficient, or I can do this with this one ability or whatever. But if those models and that ability is not winning you games, then why are you taking it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so looking at data like this is a sure thing. It's like, okay, I fully believe that, in any given Sunday type mentality, that any army can beat anybody else's army. And so if there's commonalities between these lists in the bottom 50%, and it could be you just have an older book that isn't updated. It could be that. It could also be that they've just misjudged how to take their shot in the meta, because there's commonalities within their list. So you're right. This is only like the very top level of the data, and maybe only helping frame the questions to be asked after you see this.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
It makes total sense. It's just now I have all these questions that I want answers to, and I don't know how to go about getting them from this data set.
Yeah, I don't know if it's intended
for
that.
Mike Brandt.
Well, some of the more telling stats is that it doesn't, the impact, the changes that have been made to match play or the game in general have, and then with the elements of the particular terrain build out, have seemingly mitigated the best we've ever seen the go first ratio of wins.
And so?
Oh, so, I mean, I think that's actually good because there's still a perception that if you don't go first, then you're on the back foot the entire time.
Really?
Sure. So 40K Mythbusters, you don't have to go first.
Well, you don't have to go first now, right, and with this particular terrain configuration.
Sure.
That's really interesting. So I actually don't pay attention to like a lot of the comment section because it's very tiring for me, but,
oh, just I was kidding. Not 20%. It's a solid 15% of my day. Not 20.
Oh, okay. But just from my personal experience, and this could just be because I'm a very like defensive and reactive player, but I love going second. Like I feel like I have more control over my game going second. And I mean, this is just like anecdotal and like my visceral feeling.
It's not necessarily anecdotal if it plays out for you. I mean, I think it's now more than ever in this last couple of editions, more than ever, you can deploy defensively and see how the game starts to unfold before you jump out there. Mm-hmm. And the players they got better at having a go second strategy. And I'm not saying I ever achieved this. I still like going first. But
but what's your play style?
Yeah, jump across the board, hit you with chainswords. That's my play style.
Oh, Blood Angels, right?
But the players that got better at developing that go second strategy are certainly great players.
Right. So in my last game at the tournament, I was playing against Senior Alex McDougal, and I rolled to go first and I didn't want it. So, I think we were playing battle lines actually. So I literally just moved like on each side, a custodian guard squad up and just towed the objective and then said, okay, your turn. So I effectively kind of got to go second, but I didn't get that benefit of like the last round going second and just getting to like maneuver yourself like unhindered by anything else. I don't know. That's just like a really comfortable place for me is going second. So it's really funny to me that people feel like if they roll to go second, then they're on the back foot.
No, but we know certain players that do prefer to go second. I mean, probably because look, there's a lot of explosive movement in the game now. I mean, there are armies that can jump across the table,
mm-hmm,
basically cross the entire no man's land gap on mm-hmm turn one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you build a list that lures people into that doing that, why not let them fall into that trap?
Yeah,
I just like it that we've seen it play out. But I think it is not just the addition and not just the changes to going second on turn five. Although those are big contributing elements to it, I do think that a good terrain setup or terrain keywords on terrain, let me say that, a good, like the way they've distributed keywords on terrain factors into a more even experience on the game for both players.
Mm-hmm. So I look at table layout 02 in the Warhammer packet there. And I think, how in the world is an Astra Militarum tank army supposed to play on that?
Yeah, it's tough. So the tank, you're right. How you build your list needs to be representative of this as well.
Right. So like they're essentially saying like you can take artillery and pretty much not much else on that table.
You have to play and I'm not, I know you know this, but you play the mission essentially. So mm-hmm the types of missions and where the objectives are placed, it switches, you know, as the mission switches. And so, yeah, there are games that almost every player is, you're going to come into a configuration of mission, opponent, or terrain layout, whether between one and two, that is disadvantageous.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm and how to attack that. And one of the ways you attack it is how you design your list.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me looking at that map and knowing that there was a four dreadnought custodies list in the top eight.
Yeah
So I'm like, how would that particular list, I guess they've got the Sagittarium that can like sort of zip around out past their deployment zone, but yeah, as an inexperienced player, I look at that map and go, "Hoo boy."
Well, one thing about this is only the if you're looking at this and have me follow along, I'll try to put a link in the show notes. But only the yellow pieces are neg one to hit. Everything else, if you can get line on it or whatever, you're firing at full BS, which is not something you see. You know, some tournaments do have a little bit more of the foresty type terrain on tables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just thinking like with Telemons, like I would probably have to at least deep strike, right? Because how else are you gonna like maneuver around?
Just run over there.
What?
That's my answer for everything. No, you're right. You have
just,
to
just run. Smash your way through.
Just hey, Kool-Aid. Get right on in there.
See, this is, and this as like a, as a newer player with a new faction, these are kind of like the problems that I like to think about. I like to look at the situation and look at the scenarios and think, how the heck would I even deal with that?
Yeah, we saw some of the, like, especially doing the streams, you know, actually watching the game and talking about how the game unfolds, the players that were able to trade off on objectives would typically score more points.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if they could blank a turn, you know, where prevented your opponent from getting on one objective's one turn and then start this cycle of just trading things back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Numbers are numbers. You can look at them and decide to take away certain things from them. And I do think that's it, looking at the list of what's common between the ones that are fought below 50%, and then confidently going into the game knowing that your outcome is not first round dependent, go first dependent. And I think that's the biggest takeaway from this. Keeping spirits up, keeping your own personal morale high, even if you have to lose that go first.
Or just be like me and didn't even know that it was a thing.
Hey, your own experiences influences, you know, your perspective.
Sometimes I think tuning out of like of a lot of competitive spaces, sometimes I think it is advantageous. You know, you get to create your own opinion and do your own thing.
There we go. Well, folks, that is our show for this week. I really appreciate everyone joining us. Please leave us some comments, like, share, subscribe, leave 5-star reviews. That is one of the like most hassle-free ways that you kind of tell the algorithms to let other people know that you enjoyed the show, and maybe they'll find us and maybe they'll enjoy the show as well. I hope everybody is having a great and safe start to their holiday season, or continuation of the holiday season, as the case may be. We're going to continue to release shows all the way through. Not going to take any breaks. Hope you all appreciate it. I hope you all hang out with us and look forward to hearing from you on any of the social medias.
Yep.
We'll see you all soon.
See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Tenets demand you tune in next week, for the greater good, of course.